There's a radical scene change in Revelation chapter 6. Chapters 4 and 5 are all about the glory of God in heaven. We've studied chapters 4 and 5 for 4 weeks, and it feels like it's not enough. We just scratched the surface. It's so amazing. I believe these chapters are the greatest revelation of the reality of God in the Bible. It's a big statement, but as we've studied it, you see how rich it is? See how amazing it is? It's incredible. The throne of God, the Lamb of God. God, the Almighty, Sovereign, Creator of all things. God, the Savior, in grace, coming in to redeem us by sending His Son to be as a lamb slain on Calvary. I mean, it's just so magnificent. The purpose of the book of Revelation is to show you the true reality of God. But the purpose of the book of Revelation is also to show you the true reality of the world that we live in. Now, chapter 6 is a scene change, and it's quite the change. We go from the glory of God expressed in unparalleled ways in chapters 4 and 5. We go from that to the darkness and depravity of our world expressed with great intensity in chapter 6. It's like a roller coaster ride, and you're going to get whiplash. You go from the top, and then you go back up. No! That's the book of Revelation. It's amazing. And we want to stay on the mountaintop. We want to stay in 4 and 5. We want to stay, you know, with the 144,000 who are sealed in the great multitude. We want to stay up there. But God says no. Because I must also show you the true reality of the world that you live in, or the gospel will make no sense. There's nothing in the book of Revelation that God shows you that you don't need to see. I mean, God shows us the stuff here because we actually need to see it. We have to see it. And so we bravely push on. Revelation chapter 6 is where things kind of turn dark, and we have an image, which is one of the most famous images in the book of Revelation. It's the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They come riding forth. I wanted to get a friend of mine who has a horse to ride back and forth across during the service just to sort of get your attention, but I guess I'm the only person who'd see it. We'd hear the, you know. It's the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And there's nothing for it but to dive in. We're just going to dive in. Now I watched. When the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, "Come," and I looked and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come," and out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. And when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come," and I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, but do not hurt the oil and the wine." And those food prices are 10 to 12 times what they normally were in that day and age. So there's a problem with the food. And in verse 7, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come," and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its writer's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given, that's now all the writers, they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with famine, with pestilence, and by wild beasts of the earth. And we'll stop there. We'll stop there. Just pause. Take a deep breath. The four horsemen of the apocalypse become our introduction to the trouble that's ahead. In the book of Revelation, there's a lot of trouble in the book of Revelation. And these are our introduction to that trouble. The purpose of Revelation 6 in these first verses about the four horsemen is to reveal to us the true nature of the world that we're living in. People often want to look at these verses and identify the writers with real persons that are alive in history. It becomes in some ways, sort of lined up with people that are looking for dates to set about when things are going to happen in the book of Revelation. They always want to find something specific corresponding or a person to correspond to something. And so they will say, well, the guy on the white horse, who could that be? And some people say, well, that's actually Jesus because he's on a white horse. But it doesn't seem to match up with all the rest of them. And so some people say, well, no, it's actually the Antichrist who comes riding out on a white horse, conquering and to conquer. It must be the Antichrist. And the answer is, it is neither Jesus nor the Antichrist. It is a representative figure. Each of the writers is a representative figure. In other words, they signify something. And what they signify is a package. It all goes together. Writer number one signifies the human drive for power, control, and conquest. It is a universal drive, a universal experience throughout all history, culminating in the things of the book of Revelation. Building up, build up, build up, build up. We see example, example, example in history, and culminating in the things of the book of Revelation. But it is part of a larger pattern that our world has experienced over and over again. It is that thirst for power, control, and conquest, followed up by writer number two, and that's the red horse. And he is permitted to take peace from the earth so that people should slay one another, and was given a great sword. And so writer number one signifies that quest for power, control, and conquest. And writer number two signifies war. Because what happens when you begin to fulfill that thirst, that drive for power, for conquest, for control? What happens? War happens. And what happens in war? War destroys the fabric of society. And most often in wars, more people die in the aftermath of war from things like famine than died in the war itself. And so the third rider comes along and he beholds a black horse. Its rider has a pair of scales in his hand, and a voice says, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and it's 12 times too high. And undoubtedly, this writer is representative, signifies famine. Famine, escalating food prices because things are messed up. The economy is messed up. Can't get food. And then comes the fourth seal, and it's a pale horse. It looks sickly, and this horse represents disease. Disease. In fact, in the summary, in verse 8, it says they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, famine, pestilence, disease, and the wild beasts of the earth. So it's chaos. It's war, it's famine, it's disease, it's chaos. And all of it is driven by horse number one, which is that drive for power, for conquest. And what you realize when you read this is it is an amazing sort of a condensed form explanation of world history. This is the world that we live in. Now, Jesus told us that when we saw wars and heard rumors of wars, famines, things like that, he said, don't think that the end has come. These are but the beginning of birth pangs. We'll read that passage a little bit later in Matthew 24. These are just the beginning of birth pangs. The disciples said, well, what's the sign of your coming? When's the end of the world coming? And he says, well, there's going to be wars. There's going to be famines. There's going to be earthquakes. There's going to be disease. All this stuff is going to happen. But that's not the end yet. That's just the birth pangs. That's just setting the stage. And as birth pangs increase in intensity and shorter span between them, it's like the perfect illustration of what our world has experienced. Revelation chapter 6 is still setting the stage for the unrolling of that scroll. Each seal is broken. But you know what? Here's what's fascinating about the scroll. The scroll is sealed with seven seals. And so those on the outside of the scroll, it's rolled up and there's seal, 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 seal across the lip of that thing. And the scroll is held in the hand of the Lamb of God, Jesus Christ, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. And we have come to understand that that scroll represents human destiny, the way the story ends, the final outcome of all things. God's plan and his triumph in this world, it represents the final unfolding of the story. And it needs to be opened, but there's seven seals. So each seal is taken off of it, but the scroll isn't opened yet. And one of the things that we learn through that is that chapter 6 is still setting the stage of our understanding of how to read this book and how to understand God and our world so that we can have a correct understanding of how to read the book of Revelation. What kind of a world do we live in? Now, one of the facts of human life and just our life in this world and of societies is we have a very short memory when it comes to evil, when it comes to war, when it comes to calamity. We have a very short memory, especially as it reflects badly upon ourselves. We are so fast to turn the corner on looking at humanity in a bad light and to suddenly see ourselves once again as the heroes. And all that is past. We're way past all of that. We're way past war. We're in the golden era of peace. That's what they said before World War I, by the way. It was the golden era of peace. There would be no more war. And yet, in the last 100 years, this is a really weird fact, but it's true. In the last 100 years of our history, more people have died as a result of war than all the people in all the years before in world history. That's in 100 years. So basically, I mean, there's still people alive, right? People are 100 and however many years old. In one lifetime of one person who's alive in this world, more people have died as a result of war in their lifetime than everybody in all of history who ever died because of war before them. That's the world that we live in. And isn't it weird how quick we are to forget that? How many of you think we're past all that? And we think, oh yeah, well, science has solved it. You know, we'll just educate everybody. And we'll just find a way to do this. And hey, we're there. We're almost there. And the book of Revelation is so beautiful, not only because it shows us the reality of God, but because it slams us and says, look at your world, face reality, because this is what God sees. In fact, it's what God allows. And that's where things get kind of weird. God allows this. It's all held in the hand of the Lamb, and he breaks a seal. He allows certain things to happen. It's what we call the passive judgment of God. There's active judgment and passive judgment of God. The active judgment comes later when all the seals are broken. This is what we call the passive judgment of God. And what we mean by that is that God simply allows the fruit of human sin to run its course. Well, actually, you know what God does? He actually restrains it. Only a quarter. He's like, he has to restrain it. But God, in his providence, allows human sin to take a certain course in this world, and he knows what he's doing. And he wants you and I to look at this and to say, you know what, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with our world. There's something wrong with our own lives in it. Do you know that every religion in the world and every philosophical system in the world must answer what we call the key worldview questions? You know what I mean? Key worldview questions. In other words, the key worldview questions are things like, what is the nature of ultimate reality? Is there a God or isn't there a God? Where did the universe come from? Does it mean to be a human being? Is there anything special about that or not special? And what's wrong with our world, if anything? And if so, how are we going to fix it? Those are what we call worldview questions. Every religion has to deal with those, and every philosophical system, and even science as a philosophy has to deal with that. Even atheism has to deal with that. And it's really weird if you meet a person and they go, oh, there's no problem. There's no problem with our world. It's all good. Have you ever met someone like that? They're like, no, it's all good. There's no problem. And you go, well, what about there's this weird thing with Hitler and he like killed a bunch of people? I had a guy in my car when I picked up a hitchhiker one day. This was years ago, back when it was safe to do that. And, you know, we're going along. And I'm like, hey, you know, what do you think of our world and everything? And I'm a Christian. He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, there's no good or evil. There's no right or wrong. It's all good. Everything's just good. It's karma. It's like, phew. And I said, really? That's amazing. I said, so, what do you think about Adolf Hitler and, you know, killing the Jews? He said, well, that was really silly. That's what he said. It's really silly. I go, thank you. I'll look for another worldview. That's not cutting it. That was really silly. Like, what? Are you nuts? So we had an interesting dialogue in the car. He's like, let me out. You're crazy. I'm getting out. The Bible puts in our face the reality of a broken world and lets us know that it is fallen, broken, sinful humanity and the inclinations of sinful people that are responsible for a huge amount of the evil and the suffering. There's actually a pattern to it, and it usually starts with a guy on a white horse. It usually starts with somebody who comes out conquering and to conquer. There's some power-hungry guy that is just going to do his power thing. Sometimes that guy is just nuts. Gaddafi. He's nuts. All right. Put it on tape. Send it to Libya. I'm telling you. He is. Everybody knows. Gaddafi, do you know that they broke into one of his palaces in one of the cities that they've just taken over? The opposition has taken over the outlying cities, and he's, you know, hunkered down in Tripoli. But in one of his palaces in the outlying cities, they actually went into his palace. No one had ever been in there. You know what they found? They found all kinds of occultic books on Satanism. Have you seen a photo of that guy recently, of Gaddafi? I mean, it makes Mubarak look like a saint. If ever there was a guy who was drugged out, possessed by the devil, and just nuts, that's him. And you know what? He's worth billions of dollars. So you know what the billionaire does? The billionaire says, I will hire mercenaries from other countries who, if you pay them enough, they'll do anything. I will pay mercenaries to come in and to kill my own people. And that's what's going on right now in Libya. Paid mercenaries are killing in his name. All right, so sometimes the guy is just nuts, you know, or possessed or something. Sometimes it seems far more noble than that. It's some governmental leader who feels like his people are legitimately oppressed, and he becomes violent. He starts to lash out, or he is an ideologue, you know. He's an idealist. He has some kind of radical idealism, religious or cultural, Iran. I mean, these are the scary guys. North Korea. But it doesn't just have to be them. Do you know that in any society, if you simply take away the food supply, that the worst in human nature will come out? You know, some people actually believe that the events in Egypt, not that it was the worst in human nature, but just to give you a window into this, that the events that are going on over there have to do with the rising price of food in our world, speaking of the 12 times more for the wheat. Do you know that the price of food, the price for just basic foodstuffs like wheat and corn, has doubled? In the last year, it's doubled in our world. You go, that's weird, because my food has only increased by like 1% or 2% or 4%. What do you mean it's doubled? And as someone pointed out, that's because Americans don't actually eat real food. Like, it's beautiful. This guy says, you know that when you buy your cornflakes for $4 or whatever it is, do you know that the price of the actual corn that's in the cornflakes is actually pennies? And you're paying for marketing, for transportation, for the box, you know, you're paying for the unionized workers who are, you know, doing all that. That's what the $4 is for. So when the price of corn doubles, do you know how much your cornflakes go up? About 10 cents. Do you know that in other parts of the world, when the price of corn doubles, people can't eat anymore because they're already spending, you know, 70% of their money on food? And when that happens in a society, things change. Things change. And things are changing in the Middle East. And that's partially it. But it's not always, you know, the Facebook, Google revolution of empowered people. North Korea is certainly not that way. We live in a dangerous world. And war follows. Now, in the history of our world, there's never been a time when there hasn't been war. It's been just a constant stream of war. And you know that wars are increasing in their frequency and in their intensity, kind of like birth pangs. You know, frequency and intensity. And so because I sort of needed a wake-up call in my own life, I just thought I'd review some things. I don't really always like to do this because it's actually kind of scary and depressing, but I think that we need to hear this. Of course, there's always World War II, which wasn't all that long ago, folks. Just wasn't all that long ago. I have this photo of my dad, you know, who's a navigator on a bomber in the Pacific. He was, you know, a young guy. And it's weird. It's like, wow, you were in World War II. And, you know, it was real. And it's just, wow, yeah, it was real. Someone writes about World War II, and they called that time an open-mouth grave. World War I and II, an entire generation of European youth composting the World War II battlefields. Hitler's 6 million Jews, Stalin's 20 million Soviet citizens, Mao's 10 million of political enemies and peasant famine victims, Pol Pot's 2 million Cambodians, the Tutsi Rwandans, millions of lives wasting away during the apartheid's 40-year reign. Millions and millions and millions and millions of people killed in war in a generation. Many people are unaware of what's going on in Africa, though we see the needs and, you know, the orphans and whatnot because of AIDS. But Second Congo War, also known as the African War, was the Great War of Africa, began in August of 1998 in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Officially ended July 2003. It's not very long ago. The largest war in modern African history. It directly involved 8 African nations as well as about 25 armed groups. By 2008, the war and its aftermath had killed 5.4 million people, mostly from disease and starvation. Now, you got to listen to that phrase and put it with Revelation 6. It killed 5.4 million people, but mostly from what? From famine and disease. The writer comes forth, conquering and to conquer. War is following in the wake. Famine is following in the wake. Disease is following in the wake. This is the pattern of our world. This is where we live. And I have more, and I don't even want to read it. I have more about atrocities that are committed in war. Unbelievable atrocities. Go to the Holocaust Museum. Just look at the pictures. Those pictures are not the only atrocities in war. Every war, it turns people into monsters. And it's humanity. We all say, wow, who could ever do that? Everybody. Everybody could do it. Revelation 6 is just in your face. It's like, this is the world that you live in. And not only that, the writers are writing forth. And Jesus says, you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. And more and more and more. And that's the world that we live in. And as Christians, we should never be naive about the world that we live in. Now, having said that, I want to encourage you to do something. I want to encourage you to always be watchful for the return of Christ. Always be watchful. As Christians, we should live in an attitude of expectancy because Jesus has promised to come back to this world and to set things right. So we're always watchful. But being watchful, I want to also ask you to not be a date setter. Don't be a date setter. I have a word of pastoral advice for you. Do not become a Christian who is trying to always figure out the timetable for the return of Christ. Because it will get you on the wrong track. Now, there are always people who will come and tell you that they've got it figured out. They have the date figured out. They've got the timeline figured out. And they'll want to explain that to you. Somebody sent me a link not long ago. And it was to a website that proclaimed that May 21st, 2011 would be Judgment Day in our world. And it was very serious and very intense. May 21st, 2011. And so, because we're in the book of Revelation, I had to go check it out, and I checked it out. I came to find out that, yes, indeed, May 21st, 2011, synchronize your watches, that's not very long away from now, is Judgment Day. But that the judgment then goes on for 5 months. They've got this whole reason why. 5 months. And then October 21st, 2011 is actually the end of the world. So there you go. I have a file with 200 predictions of the end of the world, of dates for the end of the world. 200. And those predictions span a time frame from the year 1000 AD till the present. About 1000 AD was when people really got into the end of the world. You know, it was the millennium, right? The millennium, and so people were kind of freaked out. And so the prophecies started coming. And really, they've been ramping up ever since then, kind of like the birth pangs. You know, it's like there's so many, and like the bulk of them are just in the last 10 years of all these prophecies that have come. Every one of them is based on a ton of biblical research. Like hours and hours and hours and hours in the Bible and a ton of Bible verses. And most usually also some personal revelation that God showed somebody just to kind of nudge them like, and by the way. So it's hard to argue with like 100,000 hours of Bible study and, you know, 100 Bible verses plus God said. You know, how do you argue with that? You got nowhere to go. Every one of them has been wrong. Every single one of them, all 200 have been wrong. All sincere people. I get stuff from people. They hand me books, pamphlets, papers, notebooks. And they'll say, God has showed me this. And, you know, I know what the chronology is. I grew up in a church that was very fascinated with prophecies and the last days and the second coming of Christ. And taught us to be expectant of Christ's return, and to live in expectancy, and that was the plus side. But the downside was that they just got a little bit too specific about all of it, in my opinion. We were taught that the generation that witnessed Israel becoming a nation once again would be the last generation of Christians in this world. You know, that'd be the generation that saw the return of Christ. The generation that saw Israel become a nation, and there's all kinds of reasons for that, why they taught that. And so in 1948, amazing, Israel became a nation. It's amazing. It is an amazing story, and it does fit into prophecy. And so, you know, it's important. But then the next thing was a generation is 40 years in the Bible. And so because they had calculated a generation is 40 years, all you had to do is do the math. 1988. But then you have to subtract 7 years because the 7-year tribulation in the book of Revelation, and you get 1981 for the rapture. And so we were pretty excited in the late 70s. Like, we were like, you know, I mean, it was just like every time anything happened in Israel, anytime there was war, anytime we were like, we were told if war breaks out in Israel, go to the church parking lot and wait for the rapture. Just go down there. Just go down there and have a sing-in and wait for the rapture to come. And actually, one time, we almost went to the church parking lot. This is a really funny story, but back in those days, I had a roommate. His name was Greg Laurie, and Greg Laurie is a big famous evangelist. And he was my roommate when I was in college for a short period of time. He was a pastor at Calvary Chapel. And they decided that what they should do at night was forward the phone calls to the office, to the pastor's homes, because, you know, there was no one there to take the call. And what if someone was in need? And so they would just go to the church office, but it would ring to a pastor's home. Well, so Greg Laurie was on the list of being forwarded to, but he never told me this. This was my phone in my apartment. He didn't tell me, all right? It's Calvary Chapel. It's a big church, right? And so one night I'm sitting there, and literally, this is a true story, war broke out in Israel. That night it was on the evening news. I didn't see it, but it was on the evening news. And not only that, Calvary Chapel had a tour group in the Holy Land simultaneously. So people were really tuned into this. And when that happened, people started calling the church office, and every call went to my apartment. I'm sitting there, you know, eating my dinner. Bring! I'm like, hello? And they're like, what's going on? Are we supposed to meet in the church parking lot? What's going on? I'm like, who are you? Is this a prank? What, you know, and I didn't even know. So I thought actually people were pranking me and I was getting nasty with them. You know, you're a jerk. Boom, I'd hang up. I didn't say that, but tone of voice, you know, probably. It would ring again. Bling. Are we supposed to go to the church parking lot? I'm thinking this is a total setup. Somebody's recording this, you know. And finally I just hung up and I didn't answer the phone and it rang all night. Bling, bling, bling. So weird. Well, that's the world that I kind of grew up in as a Christian, you know. But here's the deal, was that it didn't quite happen that way. And so then what happened was they extended the length of a generation. Oh, no, actually, it's not 40 years. It's 60. Oh, no, it's 80. You know what I'm saying? And so we have to be careful with this, to be expectant and watching, and at the same time, not setting dates. It's very important. For one thing, you can't do it. Jesus said in Matthew 24, and I'll read you this verse, Matthew 24, and in verse 36, very important verse, 24:36, but concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, for this, nor the Son, but the Father only. Concerning that day and hour, nobody knows, Jesus says. And in 24, he's talking about all these things that are going to happen in the wars and the birth pangs and the signs. And he says, but concerning the day and the hour, nobody knows, see. You can't set the date. So people say, well, he said day and hour, but he didn't say month or year. And I'm totally serious. That's how you get around it. He didn't say month and year. All right? Or they'll do tricks like, well, I'm not telling you when Jesus is actually coming back, but I'm telling you when something in the book of Revelation, the trumpet blast, or the seal, you know, number, I know when that is. And so there's always a way to get to that. But Jesus says, don't do that. Well, the other thing is that, you know, it sidetracks you from what you're supposed to be doing as a Christian. It actually sidetracks you from the real purpose of the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation's purpose is not to inform you when the rapture is going to happen. It's not to tell us exactly when Jesus is coming back. That's not the purpose. Do you know what the purpose of the book of Revelation is? I'm really, really glad that you asked, because I'm going to tell you right now the purpose of the book of Revelation. And not only that, I'm going to give you 10 purposes of the book of Revelation. 10. I just sat down and I said, we got to know the purpose of this study. And I came up with 10 things. Now, you don't have to write this down. I'll tell you why. I'm going to go through it real fast because I'm running out of time. And because we're going to put it on the web. So if you're part of My River West on the web, you will get sent to you a link that just has this paper on it. You can go to our website under resources. If you hit resources on the website, you'll see sermons, and it'll say books, and it'll say articles, and this will be under articles. It will just be one of them. I just want you to know this. Keep it in mind, because this is really powerful. 10 purposes of the book of Revelation. Number one, to reveal the awesome glory of Jesus Christ. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ. Number two, to show us Christ's heart for his church and his purpose for his church. Letters to the churches. Before anything, he talks about the church and to the church. He cares about the church. Number three, to challenge us to actually be the light of Christ for the world. The churches are the lamps, you know, the lampstands. Light of the world. He challenges us to be that. Purpose four, to show us the true reality of God. That's what we've been studying, chapters 4 and 5. The true reality of God, our Creator and our Redeemer. Purpose number five, to call us to a life response of genuine worship. Oh, Revelation is filled with worship. And we're called to be worshipers and to show us how to be worshipers. Purpose six, to reveal the reality of evil in our world for what it actually is. Chapter 6, the writers. And now later, as the book develops, what we'll find is we'll see powers that are behind those writers. We'll see the power of ultimate evil unmasked in our world. Pretty intense. Purpose number 7, to show us the fearful reality of God's judgment in our sinful world. Yes, there is judgment, and we need to know it. Purpose number 8, to give us what we need to stand strong in Christ no matter what. See, the Lord wants you to stand. In the chaos, no matter what happens, he wants you to stand strong in the Lord. Revelation shows us that and how to do that. Purpose number 9, to show us how to live as faithful witnesses for Christ, even in the face of personal difficulty or opposition. The word witness is a key word in the book of Revelation. And purpose number 10, to give us a vision of the ultimate victory of Christ over all things and our eternal hope through the gospel. And that's how the book ends. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. These things just speak to my soul. They just feed me. That's why we're studying this book. It's amazing. It's beautiful. Before we go today, I want to just read one more thing to you from Revelation chapter 6. It's all we have time for. And I want you to ponder something with me. Revelation chapter 6 in verse 9, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves had been. Now, next week we'll get to seal number 6, which is super intense. And we saw the four horsemen, which were pretty darn intense. And you get seal number 5 sandwiched into all that. What do you get? You get one seal, and it's all about followers of Christ. This is what happens in the book of Revelation. You get all these mega themes, and then it always comes back, and it focuses on followers of Christ. What does it mean to follow Jesus? What does it mean to trust him? What does it mean to wait on him? And how is Christ meeting us and caring for us? What is he asking of us? You get all that in the book of Revelation. It's really, really beautiful. I want to leave you with this thought. The book of Revelation teaches us to live our lives as a living sacrifice for Christ. Now, I know it sounds kind of creepy. You're like, well, they're martyrs and they're under the altar and like, what's that about and everything? But you got to understand something. The book of Revelation is intense pictures of spiritual reality. And the Lord is saying, not just that I want you to go die for Jesus. He's saying, I want you to live for Jesus. And as you live for Jesus in a broken world, it might cost you your life. But it isn't just about martyrdom in death. It's about living for Jesus in life fully, so the world knows you're a Christian. In a world of chaos, that you're sold out for Jesus. And whatever price you have to pay, you pay for that. The Lord has called you to fully believe in Jesus. Now, there's a story that came out 3 days ago about an imprisoned Afghan Christian. He was released from prison. His name was Saeed Musa. He was arrested in May and threatened with execution for his conversion to Christianity. And in a letter dated February 13th, he described a visit by representatives of the U.S. and the Italian embassies offering him asylum. He was visited after that by three Afghan officials who told him that he would be released within 24 hours if he wrote a statement declaring that he regretted his conversion to Christianity. That's all you got to do. All you got to do is sign this paper. Oh, I'm really sorry I converted to Christianity. What was I thinking? How dumb is that? And, you know, don't you go, well, what would I do? What would I do? I mean, this is real. This happened 3 days ago. This is our world. Just sign this letter. You regret being a Christian, and you're not going to do that anymore. Here's what he did. He wrote, I laughed and I replied, I cannot deny my Savior's name because my life is just service to Jesus Christ and my death is going to heaven where Jesus is. I am 100% ready to die. And they pushed me and pushed me, but I refused their demands. How awesome is that? That's a martyr. But you know what the word martyr means? We'll study this later. It means to be a witness. It's just a witness for Jesus. The original meaning didn't mean to die. It just meant to be a witness. He laughed. He said, are you kidding? You can't beat me because my life is to serve Jesus. And if I die, I go to be with Jesus. So deal with it. Deal with that. And he was released. But there's another man who is still imprisoned. And his name is Shoaib Asadullah. And I want you to pray for him, for Shoaib Asadullah. He's an Afghan Christian who was arrested for giving a Bible to a man who later reported him to authorities. He remains behind bars. His sentence is death, and he expects to die. Would you pray for Shoaib that the Lord will have his way and his will in his life, that he'll be a witness for the Lord in that place? And then can we take the example of both men and women like this and say, Lord, surely I can stand up for Jesus right here and right now in my culture. Surely I can live for Jesus. Yes, you can. And yes, you should. And that's the message.